Golf Smarter number 154 for November 25, 2008.
SmarterPodcasts.com. Delivering sound advice.
Golf Magazine Top 100 instructor and speed golfer Christopher Smith.
This is Golf Smarter. Each week we tap the best minds in golf to help lower your scores with tips, drills, insights, and advice. In conversation with course pros, architects, authors, players, teaching gurus, and coaches, here's your host, Fred Green.
Welcome and thanks for downloading another episode of the Golf Smarter Podcast. If you're on an iPhone or iPod Touch and you have just taken advantage of the opportunity to download podcasts, welcome to the team. I hope that you'll enjoy the show. As we stated, this is episode number 154, and we have 3 years of golf content that is as relevant today as it was when it was first published. So please, check out the entire catalog of content that we offer. We ask that you keep an eye on the Golf Smarter blog for postings of upcoming interviews, but I wanted to let you know that Fred Shoemaker, author of Extraordinary Golf and Extraordinary Putting, has agreed to return for another appearance on Golf Smarter. Fred first appeared in July of 2006, and I've been persistently asking to have him to come back. I mean, I want to also thank you because so many of you have written in to say that you too thought he was one of the most thought-provoking guests we've ever had. Anyway, the interview will be conducted on December 4th, 2008. So if you have any questions that you'd like to ask Fred Shoemaker, then click on the Hey Fred button. How appropriate. The Hey Fred button at golfsmarter.com and submit your questions. Make sure you get them in before December 4th. And also keep your eye on the blog because we usually announce what interviews we're going to be doing in the future. And if you have questions for these people, we'd like to get them in. Now, if you've been listening for a long time to the Golf Smarter podcast and you first heard the interview with Fred Shoemaker, or actually have gone back to hear previous episodes, then you'll also know that Michael Murphy, author of Golf in the Kingdom, the most popular golf fiction novel in history, was on the week after Fred. Well, as history repeats itself, I got a chance to sit down face-to-face with Michael Murphy again last week to discuss the state of golf today and the Golf in the Kingdom movie that's going into production in early 2009. That episode's coming up soon, so please stay tuned for that. Our guest today is Christopher Smith, author of I've Got 99 Swing Thoughts, But Hit the Ball Ain't One. I love that title. The subtitle really tells you a lot more about Christopher and his teaching method, but it also makes a great point. The subtitle is Pick Up the Pace to Pick Up Your Game. You may have heard about Christopher, but not realized who he is. Christopher Smith is the speed golf world record holder. Get this. He shot a 65 in 44 minutes with only six clubs. And yes, it was 18 holes. Now, this is my kind of golf story. Welcome to Golf Smarter, Christopher.
Thanks, Fred. Pleasure to be here.
I'm glad to have you. I love the title of your book. I cracked up, and so it just made me want to open, start reading. And the title being, I've Got 99 Swing Thoughts, But Hit the Ball Ain't One. That's so good. How'd you come
Thank
up
you.
With that?
You know, it's funny, that that title was actually, had already been decided when the book deal came to me from the folks at the literary agency and Crown Random House. And for those people that are familiar with the music scene, it's a play on words of one of Jay-Z's songs. And he had a hit song a couple of years ago that was, I've got 99 problems, but my bitch ain't one. Hence the title of my book.
So you play with the music themes all the way through the book. Is that something that was predetermined before you started writing as well?
You know, I do, and I have to give most of that credit to my colleague in writing crime here, Steve Eubanks, who did the book with me. He's a huge music buff, much more than I am. But there's so many similarities between playing music and learning to play music and playing golf and learning to play golf that we thought it was a great way to tie the two in and make it fun and move forward from there. So yeah, there's interesting similarities between the two. So
well, and I want to pursue that a minute. What kind of things did you discover that you felt were the same of learning and playing on both music and golf?
Well, I think it's interesting when you speak with people that play musical instruments well, and how they learned how to play that instrument. It's very, very similar to what happens with golfers and elite players and how they learned. And once we've reached a certain level, it's a purely unconscious endeavor. So the piano player doesn't sit down and think about the complex movements of his or her fingers, just like a good player is not going to think about different parts of the golf swing or their bodies while they're swinging. So once the actual motor pattern is learned, we need to let it happen unconsciously in order for it to work at its best. And that's true in both endeavors, both playing music and hitting a golf ball.
Absolutely. And when you get comfortable with either one, and I really see the correlation there, when you get comfortable with either one, you really can get lost in it without thinking about it and having success, like driving a car.
Very much so. And like most other things that we have learned to do, we do them best unconsciously, or with what we call a certain amount of unconscious competency. I think a lot of us play golf with unconscious incompetency, but it's something that we can learn. And yeah, it takes time. It takes correct repetition to learn something so that you can do it automatically or thoughtlessly. But whenever we play our best golf, I think everybody can relate to that, we do it usually with no swing thoughts, no conscious thought. We're reacting to a target, and we're feeling the shot to be played.
Yeah, you know, we had Colin Cromack on talking about the unconscious competency. Mm-hmm. He's out of Australia, and he talked about those various stages as well. And yeah, his DVD, Target Oriented Golf. Mm. But he talked frequently about that, and I love that concept. I think it's a great one. But I want to move forward to talk about speed golf with you. This,
yeah,
I found absolutely fascinating. You play a round of golf in 45 minutes.
I can, yeah. It's I got into speed golf about 10 years, almost a dozen years ago or so, Fred, and I did it basically out of lack of time. Like most of us, I don't have much time to do much, you know, most of anything. Or much of anything, especially not spend 5.5 hours on the golf course. And growing up in Eugene, Oregon, the hotbed of track and field in the United States,
sure,
had a little bit of running blood in me. But I found some very interesting things happen when I ran in between shots. And I do actually hold the somewhat unofficial, but as far as we know, the official world record in speed golf, which is a score of 65 in 44 minutes with 6 clubs. I'll say that again because that usually gets people's attention.
Yeah, please, slowly now. Let's see if you could say it slow as it takes
65.
To play.
65. Yeah, slowly. In 44 minutes, playing with 6 clubs. And basically in a competitive speed golf environment, you combine your score and your time and the lowest total wins. But what I found when I first started playing around with it was there were some remarkable things that happened on the golf course from a playing standpoint. And it really, what it showed me is that it turned golf into a reactionary sport like many other sports that we play, whether that be tennis or skiing or basketball or hitting a baseball, where instead of me thinking about it, I simply reacted to the target. So I saw the shot in my mind or the putt in my mind or whatever the circumstance was, and I reacted to it rather than thinking about it in between. And I really believe that if you took the physical demands out of speed golf, because it is depending on the golf course and depending on how you play, it's a 5 to 7 mile run where you're stopping and starting a lot, which is harder on the body. But I think it's an easier way to play because you really get out of your own way and play in a more instinctive way.
So what you're telling me is that golfers get in their own way by overthinking their shots.
Oh, absolutely, and I think we all can relate, and especially when we're playing poorly or we've hit some bad shots, is we always want to figure out why and analyze it and fix it. That's the conscious part of our mind that gets in the way when something goes wrong. That conscious side decides, well, I know what to do about it, and I know what to fix. When in reality, it's the unconscious part that has all the all the know-how and the experience and is brilliant in doing things, but what we tend to forget is we're human, so we are going to make some mistakes and we are going to make some errors. Speed golf, because of the lack of time in between shots, it seems to kind of shut down that conscious part and put us back into a more unconscious mode. You're always in the present playing speed golf because if you hit a bad shot, I mean, it's only a matter of seconds before you're at your next shot. So, you know, we hear all the fabulous sports psychologists speaking about staying in the present, which is much easier said than done. Well, in speed golf, you're always in the present because that next shot is literally seconds away.
I'm not a runner. I've never been a runner. I've never been very good at running. I was actually the guinea pig and the target in middle school, and people used to chase me. The gym teacher would say, if you catch Fred, if you lap Fred and catch him, then Fred's going to have to run extra. It's like, why do I get punished here? Because I'm so slow. Luckily, I kept them laughing and they wouldn't catch me on purpose. I do like to walk a golf course. And living in Northern California, we have not very many flat courses. And I know that when I say I have to walk up a hill to get to my next shot, it's going to take me a while to catch my breath, even though I'm used to walking, to slow myself down so I can make the next shot. But I guess you're trying to keep your heart rate and your breath rate up to a certain point in a round of speed golf.
Yeah, that's probably the biggest challenge and ironically the most difficult part of speed golf, like for many people with traditional golf, is putting. It's essential to try to get the heart rate down a little bit when you go to putt. I think the easiest thing for most people to compare a round of speed golf with would be an Olympic biathlon, where the individuals are cross-country skiing with a rifle on their back, and then they're stopping and having to hit a target. So you're combining a very cardio-oriented sport, cross-country skiing or running, with a very target-specific sport, hitting a golf ball or shooting a rifle. And controlling the heart rate is very important. I know a lot of the top-level biathletes, they actually hold their breath as they're shooting the rifle because it calms the heart rate. So it's a challenge, and speed golf really is just an extreme version, Fred, of playing a little bit faster. It's not something that's going to go over with the masses, and at the same time, it's remarkable to watch around and to see what can happen when we take all these things that we think are necessary in a round of golf, from practice swings to over-reading putts to having exact yardages, and you take them out of the realm, and it's amazing what can happen.
How many speed golfers do you think are out there these days? And you know, are you guys organized?
We do. We have an organization. We have several small tournaments every year. I think there's a lot of potentially great speed golfers in the woodworks. Just a lot of people have never tried it. The most challenging part is trying to find a golf course to play on, because obviously there can't be anybody in front of you.
So you have to play first thing in the morning.
Yeah, either dark 30 in the morning or late in the evening, or organized tournaments. After shotgun tournaments are times to play as well.
Oh my gosh, golf courses would love you guys. That they can get a whole tournament in and let everyone play a full round that day.
Yeah, exactly. That's the biggest challenge, and I think that's the biggest reason it has not really grown as far as how many people are out there playing speed golf. But I believe its merits, and quite frankly, this 99 Swing Thoughts, the book deal was presented to me after a literary agent saw an article that I did for Golf Digest in February of 2006 based on the benefits of speed golf. And it doesn't have anything to do with necessarily running in between your shots or being fit, but all these wonderful things that happen when you take less time, when you play less consciously and more instinctively. And really the 99 Swing Thoughts is a larger version of the article that I did for Golf Digest.
I see. You tell a great John Daly story about putting. Please share it with us.
Yeah, well, JD would be a phenomenal speed golfer. I don't know how you'd get him between.
Yeah, right.
350-yard drive in the next one. But You know, and when you watch John play, he plays really, really fast. In fact, a lot of the guys, you know, they're walking and talking as he goes into his swing, and John just gets up and hits it, and I think that's somewhat the way he's wired. He's wired in a rather unique fashion in other ways as well, but he really doesn't believe that that a lot of the things we do when we putt are necessary, and you know, he relates it to trying to sign somebody's name. If you sign your name and then you try to sign it again in exactly the same way, it's very difficult to do. Or the story that I tell in the book of John is him asking someone to point at a water tower off in the distance, and they look at the tower and they point at it, and it's very, very accurate. And then he asks them to take a lot of time in setting their body and pointing their finger at the water tower, and it really doesn't help. It really doesn't, and that's how people approach putting and other parts of golf. So it's an interesting scenario.
So how do you translate that to your students in teaching the various aspects of golf? And you are a Class A PGA instructor?
I am. I'm the PGA lead instructor at Pumpkin Ridge Golf Club outside of Portland, and I've been a professional coach and learning facilitator is really the two words that I prefer now. teaching professional, I am a PGA member and have been for the last close to 10 years. And I think it's a bit of a relief for some people, and it's very challenging for others that have been brought up in a golf educational environment where it has been full of what I would call how-to swing thoughts. I don't really believe that we learn to do anything to a very large extent by being told how to do it. I think there's a large part of discovery to it. And I think as an instructor or a teacher, if I put that name on myself, that really all I'm helping my students to do, I'm helping them to learn what the optimal way for them is to hold the golf club, swing the golf club, and play the game. And I know for a fact when you watch the best players in the world, they all do it differently. And I'm very fortunate to be out on tour several weeks a year. And I stopped trying to find the secret because everybody does it so very differently. And I think that's refreshing to students, Fred, as well, that we're not trying to put everybody in the same mold, use the same method, rather find what's best for the individual.
What kind of things do you use for people who are not runners, who don't have that kind of capacity? But how do you bring those elements of speed golf into your teaching, and what specific things do you bring in there that translate very easily for most golfers?
Yeah, I think one of the things that's pretty simple, Fred, is, and I do this mostly around the green just because the distances are shorter, but if you hand somebody a golf ball just standing out there next to the green and you ask them to toss the ball to a particular hole or even on the putting green. And I've been doing this for a long time now. I've been a student and a player of the game for 35 years and a professional instructor for 20, but I've never seen anybody stand there and just deliberate and take practice tosses with their arm and fidget over how they're standing. They simply look at the target and they toss. Now, and I asked him, I said, well, what did you think about? Did you think about how far back you swing your arm? Did you think about shifting your weight? Did you think about taking a step forward and rotating your hips? And they just giggle. They just laugh. They say, of course I didn't. And I said, well, how'd you do that then? Well, I just looked and I tossed. So why can't we do the same thing with there's a ball on the ground. There's a stick in your hand. It's a funny looking stick and it's got a head on it. And there's a target out there. And I think once we've learned the motor pattern or the motor skill that is the golf swing, just like tossing a ball is a motor pattern as well, that thinking about how to do it is only going to destroy our ability to do it. And so I think when I watch people toss or throw, they do it much more instinctively. And it's my job then to get their golf swing up to par with their throwing abilities. So that's a pretty good example of tapping into something that people already do and they already know.
So people are just spending way too much time with each shot, thinking about each thing, overthinking everything. You believe that? I mean, you know.
I do.
Go ahead.
Yeah, and I think part of the challenge too, Fred, is in fairness, people go onto the golf course, which for me is the same as time to take the test. It's time to play the game, and they really haven't learned the skill of hitting the golf ball yet. They haven't really taken the time, and it does take time. And I go into that in my book as well, is when you've there's a lot of research that's been done on how long it takes and how much repetition to become a master or even an expert in something. And it takes a lot of time and a lot of correct repetition. I think good coaching and good guidance can expedite the process. But I think what happens to most people is they get on the course and they haven't learned it yet, whatever it is. So they're trying to learn it while they're in the game situation, while they're in the battlefield, while they're in the test-taking situation. So it's kind of like a 15-year-old who's got his driving permit decides to go enter the Daytona 500. You know, it's they're gonna struggle.
Scary thought.
So I think, in fairness, I think that's why people are buried with all these thoughts, is they haven't learned how to do it yet, and so they go out onto the course because that's why they're learning to play, and they haven't acquired the skill yet. They haven't done enough of their homework yet. I equate it to somebody, again, going in to take a test, and you can't study and do your homework while you're taking the test. You've either done the homework or the studying, or you haven't, and it's time to go. And so once you're on the golf course, I think it's important to play with what you got that day. That's true for any level player. And there's always room for improvement. Even the best player in the world, Tiger Woods, is constantly trying to get better with whatever and many things that he's doing. So I think it's important that you go out onto the course that particular day, and whatever's going on with your golf ball, you got to accept it and deal with it and play with it for that day, or dance with who you brung, as Sam Snead used to tell us.
Sure. Because tinkering, I guess, could be – tinkering during your round could be the total kiss of death. I played with a guy just this last weekend, and he said, yeah, well, you know, if this isn't happening by the third hole, then I know I got to change this, and then I'm changing this. And he's constantly tinkering, and I'm like – you know, but for me, it's when things aren't working right, I just try to forget all that has happened that day and just get back to just what a basic swing is for me, to get back to what I'm the most comfortable with. Doesn't mean I have any success, but
that's probably the wisest choice, though, Fred, is I think at the very least, if you can go back to something that you know, and it may not be optimal, it may not be ideal what you know, but rather than going out and trying this or that to get the ball to go in a place, you know, other than where it's going. I mean, golf, when you boil it down to what is it that in reality, it's getting the ball from point A to point B. That's what it breaks down, and everybody gets it there in a different fashion. And there's certainly
different
ways.
You just like to get it there really fast.
Well, I do, yeah. I try to get it there fast and stay in shape so I can get from point A to point B a little faster. But, I would agree with you. I tell people that, you know, it's been my experience. If I had a soothsayer come down and visit me as I was standing on the warm-up tee and told me, hey, you know, Christopher, every shot you hit today is going to slice 50 yards, every single one. If I had that knowledge, what I would do, I'd go out and shoot in the 50s because I'd aim 50 yards to the left every time and I'd let it slice 50 yards back to the target. Now, the 30 handicapper would take that same information from the fortune teller or soothsayer and they'd say, well, I don't want to slice it 50 yards. I want to draw it, or I want to hit it straight. Go out and shoot 150 trying to fix it. Mm-hmm. Then their ball would go left and right, and it'd hit some good. Then they'd hit curve some to the left, and it'd be all over the place. Now, I might get done with my round and come in and say, hey, you know what? I don't know if I want to play every shot the rest of my life slicing at 50 yards. So now I'm going to work on it. I'm going to learn something new, learn something better, assimilate something better here on the practice ground rather than trying to learn it on the playing field.
I had a conversation once with Lynn Marriott and Pia Nilsson about their books, and one of the things that stood out to me was the idea of doing most of your thinking about your shot before you step up to the ball. Then when you get up to the ball, just hit the ball. You know, the thought box and the shot box, I think is what they called it. And it just seems that we tend to spend way too much time thinking once we stand over the ball about all the little things. And may I quote the name of a book that I've recently read called I've Got 99 Swing Thoughts, But Hit the Ball Ain't One. But we really aren't thinking about hitting the ball. We're thinking about everything else that has to be done so that we can swing the club and hopefully make contact and follow through and end up with our, you know, our belt buckle facing the target and blah, 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 blah.
You got it. A lot of blahs in there.
Blah. Yeah. Blah, blah. It's a par four blah.
It is challenging, Fred. And again, I think in fairness, you know, a couple things happen. We have the golfer hasn't learned how to make the swing to get the ball from point A to point B. Or because we're human, the golfer makes a bad swing and then the conscious part of our mind has to rear its ugly head and try to tell us how to do it differently instead of just accepting, hey, you know, I'm human. I made a bad swing. I hit a bad shot, which everybody does.
Right.
I'm not going to try to fix it. I think those two things get in the way. I think there are some remedies, some tools, and some strategies that we can use to quiet those swing thoughts or to shut up the bothersome conscious mind, and I help my students with those at times.
Could you share one or two with us?
No, they're really big secrets.
Please, I said please.
They're not, and I think you see good players doing this. The first is something that I learned many years ago from a good friend of mine and colleague, Dr. Craig Farnsworth, who is a vision and concentration specialist and has worked with a lot of different tour players, primarily with their putting. Author of See It and Sink It. And I got to know Doc when I was teaching in the California desert many years ago. And Doc always had a real simple phrase that has helped me and has helped others. And it has to do with your eyes. And we like to tell golfers that when your eyes are active, your mind is passive. And when your eyes are passive, your mind is active. I'll say that again.
Please.
When your eyes are active, your mind is passive. So think of a good player standing over a putt or a ball. The eyes are constantly going between the ball, maybe the intermediate target, the target. They're very active. Conversely, most players that do have too many swing thoughts, heaven forbid, 99, their eyes are passive, so their mind is active. So what would passive eyes be? Staring at the golf ball. I think anytime we see someone staring or looking at the golf ball for more than 2 seconds, that individual is in trouble because you know their mind is going nuts, and normally the resulting swing or stroke is not going to be a very good one. So keeping your eyes active between the ball and the target, the ball and the intermediate target, the club face, whatever that be, that may be, that can be very, very helpful in quieting the conscious and disturbing, bothersome conscious mind down.
That's really good. Oh, I really like that a lot.
There's one other thing that I found, and I stumbled onto this a little bit until I learned about it, and it's a real no-no in golf, apparently, is the actual act of talking, like we are right now, is a very conscious act. Mm-hmm. So one way to quiet thoughts down is to try to keep the conscious part of the mind intact or quiet the conscious part. So when we talk, I'm occupying my conscious mind. So I have many, many students who hit their best shots, Fred, whether that be on the golf course or on the practice lesson tee, when they're in the middle of a sentence.
Get out.
Because they're talking, and it might not have anything to do with golf. It might have to do about who won the game this weekend or what movie they saw or where they're going to dine that evening as they're swinging. So what that does is it shuts up or it occupies or quiets the conscious part of the mind. That's the part that's going to, you know, tell us how to swing the club, what swing thought, what to do. And it allows the brilliant all-knowing and very experienced non-conscious part to take over to perform the task, which is swinging the club, moving the stick to get the ball to go from point A to point B. So I think it's great for people to talk while others are swinging. Or while you're
swinging. Let's make sure that this is clear. It's okay to talk while you're swinging, but I wouldn't advise talking while somebody else is swinging unless you want to start a fight.
Perhaps. That's something I've had to learn to do with speed golf, is because I don't have time to wait over my shot. A lot of these events and competitions are determined, the finishing score is less than a minute. And so I've become very immune to any distractions as far as cars going by or people talking. And that is challenging. But try having a conversation in the middle of your swing next time with your playing partners and see what happens.
They'll be laughing at you. They'll respond, and you'll turn around and go, "Shut up, I'm talking."
Yeah, exactly.
And I'm swinging.
Then people, of course, have to work on their listening skills, which is a whole other ball of wax.
That made me think, is speed golf a solitary game? I mean, can you play with a twosome or a foursome? It's going to slow everybody down, right?
Yeah, in its competitive form or how it's played, Fred, it is a solitary sport. So okay. People will tee off in increments every, let's say, 4 to 5 minutes. You don't want to have two or three people on the same hole flailing away and having to put helmets on and trying to hit one another. So that doesn't give the game a good name. And normally players are seated like they would be in other events, whether that be skiing or whatnot, where the fastest and the better players will go out first so as to try to avoid at all costs someone having to play through. But playing through does happen in speed golf, yeah.
And when you shot your 65 in 44 minutes, that is a net or gross 65? I mean, is that with the time? Did you actually take 65 strokes in that round?
Yes.
And so you add 44 minutes to that?
Correct.
So your score that day was 109?
Correct. Yep.
And that's the unofficial world record.
Yeah, I shot that in Chicago. We had an annual tournament in the fall, actually, in Chicago at Jackson Park, which is south side of Chicago. And relatively short and flat golf course, in fairness. It was just a round where I think, as we all know, I think more than anything else, my mental state or my attitude was optimal that day. It was
absolutely
ideal. And
is 65 the lowest score you've ever shot in golf?
I've had a couple other competitive rounds in sectional events here in the Pacific Northwest, PGA section of 65, but never in that little a time. And again, in most of the speed golf formats in this day and age, we carry our own clubs. Now there was some events in the past where we actually had a caddy
chasing
with
you.
A golf cart, yeah, and the whole tool set, all 14 clubs, and it was fun and it was a little bit faster, but it the logistics of it, the dynamics were a little challenging. So what we've moved to is basically the individual. You can take as many clubs as you want, but you got to carry your own. So 14 gets pretty heavy, and I stumbled onto and settled on 6 clubs. It just seemed like a fair amount with a small bag that was much lighter. And the beauty in that, obviously, it's faster when you're running, but playing with only a half a set or fewer clubs, again, it forces the golfer, Fred, to be more creative and use their imagination.
Interesting.
Which, as Mr. Einstein told us, is much more important than knowledge and information. So when we're out playing with, and this is something that I have many of my students do, particularly the better players, without running in between shots, but I'll have them play for 3 or 6 months, sometimes even 9 months, with a half a set of clubs. And it forces the player to learn how to hit golf shots, to be more creative in distances and the types of shots that you're trying to hit, and really get into more playing golf rather than playing golf swing. So it's an important part, I think, of developing skill at getting the ball to go from point A to point B in the fashion that you want.
And which 6 clubs do you carry?
Yeah, I settled on a driver, a fairway wood that's got about 17 degrees of loft on it, so I guess that'd be a 4 or 5 wood in this day and age. a 5-iron, an 8-iron, 1 wedge, and the putter. And, you know,
wait a minute. I only got 5. The driver, the fairway wood.
Fairway wood.
Oh, the 5-8 wedge, and okay.
And a putter, yeah.
Yeah, amazing. Amazing. And, that's fabulous.
Yeah, I get stuck every once in a while, but it's good for me to try to do something new. I actually played that way for almost a year, all the time. I just decided, you know, what the heck. And I'll tell you, the bag's a lot lighter. It's a real pleasure to carry instead of 14 clubs. And
which wedge do you carry?
You know, I carry like a gap wedge, about a 52-degree model.
Uh-huh.
And again, that helps me to learn to hit different shots around the green and hit different distances, which I think is a big part of playing good golf. I entered the Oregon Open a couple of years ago, which is one of our big sectional events, and I hadn't played a normal round of golf and almost a normal competitive round of golf in almost a year. I'd just done a lot of speed golf, and I was playing with my 6 clubs, and I decided I'm going to go play this Oregon Open. And I thought, well, I better take a few more clubs because otherwise the guys are going to look at me funny. So I added I put another wedge in, a more lofted wedge. And then I went 5-7, 9-iron, and I added a little hybrid 21-degree thing. So I played with 9 clubs in the Oregon Open. And it's a 54-hole tournament. I shot 11 under par for 3 days and lost in a playoff, almost won the event.
Wow.
And, it seemed easy with 9 after playing with 6. So I can only imagine what 14 will be like again someday.
Fabulous. Well, again, the book is called I've Got 99 Swing Thoughts, But Hit the Ball Ain't One. Pick Up the Pace to Pick Up Your Game by Christopher Smith with Steve Eubanks. It's available on Amazon, which means that if you're interested in purchasing a copy, you can do it at the Smarter Shopping page of golfsmarter.com. But Christopher also has his own website, which is christophersmithgolf.com. And on there, he has an audio CD as well called Better Golf, Whole Brain Learning by Christopher Smith. Christopher, thanks so much. Congratulations. We hope to be seeing the Speed Golf Championships on ESPN or the Golf Channel quite soon. They would love it because an hour of programming and you can have the whole day. It's like they don't have to spend the whole day and they can sell a lot of sponsorship on that one.
Absolutely.
Thanks so much for spending your time with us. I really appreciate it. Some great insights.
Thanks very much for having me, Fred. I enjoyed it very much. Thank you.
Only 1 week left to register to win the Golf Ring. Now, whether you use it for putting, chipping, or pitching, this is a tremendous product that will help you improve your target orientation skills. So go to golfsmarter.com and click on the contest tab to enter and win the 6-foot Golf Ring. Deadline for entries is November 28th, 2008. And while you're filling out your entries to win the Golf Ring, click on their banner at the top of the contest page because Golf Smarter listeners have been provided with an exclusive offer. When you purchase the Golf Ring, the 6-foot Golf Ring, and use the checkout code GOLFSMARTER, the spot ring will be included in your order at no extra charge, plus you'll receive 15% discount on your total order. The Golf Ring is a 6-foot ring, and the spot ring is an 18-inch circle that create a great target when you really need to isolate your focus. So you can win the 6-foot circle, or as a Golf Smarter listener, get the 15% discount and the free 18-inch circle as well. Just make sure you use the checkout code GOLFSMARTER at thegolfring.com. Now, I want to congratulate Nick Chertok. Nick wrote into our Golf Smarter group on Facebook.com that he nailed his second hole-in-one. He did it last week in Santa Rosa, California. Our Golf Smarter group is growing each week with golfers from all over the world getting into discussions and answering questions. Log in and join on the conversation. It's not a lot of your time, but it is a lot of fun at facebook.com. The group is called Golf Smarter. We close today's program with a quote submitted by my friend Ken Aderman of San Rafael, California. Not sure who said it, but the source isn't that important. Our quote is, when your shot has to carry over a water hazard, you can either hit one more club or 2 more balls. Next week, a finalist from Golf Channel's For Inventors Only, Dean Thompson, who created the perfect putting machine. He'll join us to talk about putting, putters, and saving strokes on the green. If you have any quotes, comments, suggestions, or questions, please click on the Hey Fred button at golfsmarter.com.
The Good Dog Podcast is for people who are passionate about dogs.
I love my dogs.
I interview veterinarians, dog behaviorists, and a whole range of experts who offer tips and insights.
A good German Shepherd makes decisions. It will say, well, you know, I know the light just changed, but on the other hand, there's a very quiet Prius coming your way, and so I'm going to stop, whereas labs have a tendency to just follow rules.
You'll hear about some amazing canines who help their owners to be safe, and in some cases, alive.
Sometimes diabetics will test and they'll still be at 100 saying, I'm not going low, what are you talking about? And the dogs let them know before they even feel it.
And you'll pick up ideas for solving a host of challenges.
Within a week, you're going to have a dog that is calm, he lies down quietly, he's just going to be a totally different dog.
I'm Joanne Green. Please subscribe to the Good Dog Podcast, found in iTunes or at smarterpodcasts.com.